Happy New Year and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway and I'm reading my way through the 1980 Deities and Demigods supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition. And as I do, I'm talking about the gods, heroes, and mythological beings that I find in it, and how to use them, and religion and mythology more generally, in your fantasy role-playing games. This is the last episode of our section on Chinese mythology, and in the next episode we're going to be starting up on the notorious Cthulhu Mythos section of Deities and Demigods. It's going to be coming in January, so don't miss out. It's been a weird one, this Chinese mythology section, and in this episode, we're going to talk about what conclusions we can draw from it, and what, if anything, got left out, and some ways to use this information in your campaign. I said right back at the beginning of this section that I didn't want to spend too much time bagging on this book's authors, Jim Ward and Rob Kuntz, because they were working with a lack of sources hard to imagine from the internet-enabled modern day. In fact, as I worked on this section, it became clear to me that, you know, even too, I like to think of myself as a relatively well-informed layman when it comes to religion and the history of religion. I know a certain amount about Chinese history. I don't speak Chinese, and I have access to a very good university library, and the available English language sources to me actually seemed quite limited, and that must have been even more the case nearly 40 years ago when the research for this book was happening. So I don't want to spend a lot of time harping on the ways in which I think Ward and Kuntz maybe didn't do an amazing job, because I feel like they really were doing their level best with the resources that they had available to them. However, in response to the failures of some of these resources, they did make some decisions that I'm not sure I would have made. I am maybe a little bit more of a historical purist than most people, so, you know, you can take this with a grain of salt, but in particular, I think things like turning the protective deity Ma Yuan Shuai into some kind of tyrannosaur monster takes him so far away from what he's originally intended to be that it's just odd to do it in the first place. I would feel better if you made something up, because it's not like you're trying to associate the well-known character of Ma Yuan Shuai with your tyrannosaur monster. It just feels like a weird misreading. The same is true of the transformation of Ho Yi into some kind of bat demon. The weirdest of all of these things, I think, is the demonification of Domu, who is a benevolent goddess. So I feel like there's some choices that Ward and Kuntz made in response to the lack of information that they had available that they just feel a bit off to me. And I think it partly niggles at me because, with no disrespect intended to my pagan friends, Chinese traditional religion is a living and significant spiritual practice in the way that maybe worship of Odin is not. And obviously there are people that worship Odin or that involve the Norse gods in their religious practices, but, you know, not hundreds of millions of them. So that, I don't know, I wouldn't say that I have any, like, principled or articulable objection to it, but just somehow it sits a little uneasily. And I don't know that I have more to say about it than that it makes me feel a little bit uneasy. But obviously, you are the best judge of kind of how much fidelity to the actual religion you want to include. Some people think that that's actually the more offensive choice. In Authentic Thaumaturgy, a book that I'm not going to talk about, Isaac Bonovitz insisted that to use real-world religion of any kind in your games in any way was impermissible, and you should make up fantasy deities from the whole cloth. For reasons of divine retribution. Anyway, I'm not saying that, but I do feel like some of the choices that those authors made, they might not have been as cavalier about with another religion. And I think the lack of exposure of Western culture generally to Chinese traditional religion in other than like the most kind of superficial way through kung fu movies and stuff, you know, probably plays a role here. That this is still can be presented as something that's sort of exotic and mysterious rather than an important part of the cultural life of a big chunk of the world's population. I was originally going to say that this is something that you have to think about if you're including real-world religious elements in your games, but honestly, I don't suppose you do have to. Because when you're running your game, you're obviously not doing something that's intended for public consumption. You know your audience and you know what they will find offensive, but me personally, it sits uneasily. Alright, let's talk about using Chinese mythology as inspiration for your fantasy role-playing games. I mean, this is where we take the tales of the various deities and heroes that we've seen discussed in this chapter and elsewhere, and we springboard off of them to do different but related things for fantasy games. And here, I think, is where Werner really shines. You should get your hands on a copy of Werner. The ebook is free online. paper versions are, you know, a couple of, I don't know what the U.S. publishing situation is like, but I can't imagine that they're that much more expensive. You know, it's a public domain work. And it's just full of, like, wild and colorful stories. And the same is true for, like, the Naja animated film that I linked to a couple of episodes ago, or anything like that. You know, you should just go and take these stories as stories and incorporate them into your D&D game. There are a couple of ways, I think, that, I mean, obviously, I think that that's true of really all mythology, but there are a couple of specific aspects of Chinese mythology that I think can be a lot of fun. First up, this is the first pantheon we've looked at that is really huge. The Finnish mythology section was really scraping the bottom of the barrel to get enough characters to pad it out to its full length. But there are dozens, if not hundreds, of deities who are not included in the Chinese mythos section, any of whom would be as worthy of inclusion as Ma Yuan Shuai, or even maybe Ne Zha. And I feel like the huge pantheon actually has really great world-building opportunities in it. I think that there are sort of two sweet spots for creating gods for a D&D campaign, because there are certain types of players who love to, like, learn the lists of world building, and particularly if the world building is exceptional, I can be one of them. I could talk for hours about the religion and mythology of Glorantha, because I love Glorantha, but I think we can all accept that Glorantha is exceptional among fantasy settings, and that most settings, the religion is not as fun to talk about. If you think about the deities of a typical Dungeons & Dragons pantheon, they're all a bit predictable for the most part. And that means that memorizing long lists where nothing in that list is going to be exciting or interesting or novel, that's a little dull. So the sweet spots are like 1 to 3 gods, and then a bazillion gods. It's in the middle where the problems occur. If there were 15 gods in this culture, not an unusual number, if there are 15 gods in this culture, and I have to know all of them and what they do, I'm gonna try, but I'm going to fail. But if there were zillions of them, then it would be fine, right? Then you'd have a kind of, like, picaresque structure where, okay, I know the gods that my village worships, and then when I go to this village, there's going to be a shrine to some gods, and I'm not going to think that's unusual. I'm just going to say, hey, old wise woman, tell me about the gods that are worshipped in this temple. And then she would tell me, and it would turn out to be related to that mysterious old ruin in the mountains, and then that's where the bugbears are, and so on. So just saying right at the outset, yeah, there's squillions of gods, and you need to know about Shangdi and Guan Yin and so on, but if you go to some local village, and they're all worshipping Chijang Tzu, and you're like, I don't know who that guy is, that should not surprise you or make you suspicious. It's just such a time-saving effort in a fantasy world. It spares the players the need to know a lot of different deities that have to be memorized. I don't feel any wiser or better for knowing who Pelor is, and I feel like I could do without that information. If in a scenario, you know, I was looking at some murals in a dungeon, and the DM said, ah, yes, these are murals of Pelor, the sun god, and how he brought the light of truth to fight off the darkness of sin, I'd be like, yeah, okay, that makes perfect sense. I feel like I know everything I need to know about this guy now. Which is just part of another world building. You include world detail through stuff. Great big pantheons, paradoxically, are actually more accessible to players, because they allow you to present information about the world contextually, rather than, like, in the form of a big list. I'm not saying that learning things as a big list can't be fun, but this also has an added benefit for the DM, which is that it allows you to keep your options open. If I decide that this culture needs a god who punishes people who break contracts, and I've established that this society has umpty billion gods all in a complex and often contradictory hierarchy, then I can introduce the god who punishes people when they break contracts, and no one will say anything about it. It'll make perfect sense. If someone goes, wait a minute, I thought you said this other guy was the god of the rain, and I can just go, look, it rains a lot, all right? It's just so much easier for me. And I feel like we have this kind of vestigial, maybe 80s D&D thinking, where we think that's cheating, but I don't know why creating something right now is bad, whereas creating it previously is good. They're both creativity. They just happen at different times. Anyway, that's a side note. Great big pantheons, try them out, you'll find they actually have a lot of world-building advantages. Some DMs like to prepare absolutely everything in advance because it helps them feel more confident, and I do understand that. But if you feel okay just inserting stuff as you go, then establish yourself a couple of principal deities, and then that there are squillions of lesser ones, and it just gives you so much freedom in terms of your world-building. Okay, the next idea that you ought to steal from Chinese mythology is the cosmic order, the mandate of heaven, idea of a providential structure that incorporates both the natural and the social and the metaphysical worlds, and the idea that these things are intimately connected to each other. Now, in Chinese mythology, as we've seen, this has tended to be used as a tool to reinforce the importance of hierarchies, right? By saying that the social and political order and the natural order are both reflections of a cosmic order, we're casting any attempt to resist the social order as unnatural. And I can understand if that doesn't really sit right. It doesn't fit with a lot of how we view the world today, and it doesn't fit with how most Dungeons & Dragons parties, who tend to be a little more antinomian, view the world. Now, back in an early episode, I suggested that you have to disrupt the order in order to make it work. That is to say, if you're going to have characters who are fighting for a cosmic social order, they have to be fighting for its restoration in a period of anarchy or dystopia. By contrast, you can also subvert the natural order, right? So you have characters who are raised believing that the political order and the natural order are combined, and then as they grow in power and importance and they wind up with more contact with the divine, they find that, in fact, you know, heaven is not really the well-oiled machine that they have always imagined, and that Shang-Di is, in fact, like kind of an absentee landlord, and the different gods are always squabbling. The squabbles between these different gods are a common theme in Chinese literature, or a certain type of Chinese literature, as I understand it, and that is because while there may be this like theological concept of heavenly harmony that's really important, the fact is that fights between gods are rad, and people like to read about them. People with superpowers flying around on their wind fire wheels and breaking each other's unicorns in half with their staves, that's cool. And so we want a situation that tends toward cool stuff, and I feel like subverting the cosmic order by pointing out that either it's fundamentally unjust or it's not really real manages to, like, provide entertaining chaos without undercutting lawful characters, right? Because we can say, look, there is no cosmic harmony. There is no harmony except the harmony you make. There is no right conduct except the right conduct that you practice. If you are a lawful character, you can't just be like, oh, well, heaven is on my side. You have to go out there and fight for what you believe is right. You can't rely on Shang-Di to take care of it for you. So I think the idea of the cosmic order as something that characters can be in favor of or opposed to, I think is a lot more interesting than the idea that there is kind of a fundamental underlying cosmic order, unless you give that cosmic order the boot and make restoring it the player character's goal, because ultimately, very orderly settings can sometimes have the problem of diminishing player agency. Interesting that, like I said, there aren't necessarily bad guys in the sense that we would understand them in this mythology, or at least not as they appear in my reading, limited though that is with respect to the vast scope of Chinese religious belief. But I guess what I mean is that this does seem to be one of those instances where the struggle between law and chaos is much more important than the struggle between good and evil. The third idea that we can swipe from Chinese mythology is the way that history and mythology combine. Lots and lots of the deities that we've seen in this deities and demigods section are said to be historical people, right? That they either they began their lives as humans and then they were deified, like Guan Yu, that they were reincarnated as mortals, like Ma Yuan Shuai, or that they were born into a mortal form, like Ne Jia, or that, like, human expressions of a divine principle are somehow, it's not really clear, which was the case with Zhao Gongming. What this gives you is an opportunity to combine your settings, history, and mythology, a world in which King Arthur and Robin Hood and Billy the Kid and, I don't know, Grania O'Malley are all quasi-divine figures. And I think that opens up a lot of inspiration, particularly if it's just such a well-known fact of the religion that player characters at level one are having the thought like, well, what could I do to become a god, right? It's a much more seamless integration of the idea of player characters becoming divine if you can just kind of start them out with the idea, well, think of all these deities in the past, like, you know, Guan Yu was just so righteous that he was deified after his death. That is the normal, like, that's, you know, Guan Yu got to a really high level, and when he died, the adventure didn't stop. And that allows you to put the divine world right into the lives of rogues and fighters. and wizards, as well as clerics and paladins, which is always a bit of a challenge, right? That you're always going to wind up with, you know, clerics, paladins, and druids who are quite pious, and, you know, rogues and fighters and barbarians and monks and whatever who don't really care, even though you'd expect monks to be religious, but the divine just doesn't really have that much of an impact on their life. And here you can, because you just be like, oh yeah, this was so-and-so. He was a great monk. Like, he did Kung Fu so well that he's now a god, which, you know, is a one-sentence summary that you could apply to several of the characters in Werner. So I think the idea of blurring the human and the divine is something that occurs in D&D pantheons less than it occurs in any of the pantheons by which they're inspired. So blur that line, because it makes the divine world more real and accessible to player characters. And it's definitely what I do if I wanted to run the kind of campaign that this book clearly thinks you're going to run, which is where we track down Utu and we give him a shoo-in and we steal his flying chariot thing. I don't recommend it, but if that's how you want to roll, then you need to lay the brickwork early. The fourth thing that you can swipe from Chinese mythology to use in your D&D game is the idea of multiple quasi-compatible mythologies. We've seen a bunch of deities who have very different aspects when viewed from a Buddhist perspective or a Taoist perspective, but where those different aspects don't seem to be a problem for their worshippers. That is to say that we have deities whose origins are, I mean, in the case of Yan Wang, who goes back to Hindu belief, and via Buddhism then enters traditional Chinese religion and has slightly different versions of what are essentially the same deity appear in all of those mythologies. That's fantastic, and we need more of it. There tends to be this kind of, like, bounded version of most deities in Dungeons & Dragons, like, oh, well, the Kuoto worship Blibdulbulb, but the Sohagen worship someone else completely different. I have no idea who. It's odd that elves and humans, you know, cohabit and even produce children, but, you know, elves worship Corlun Lorethi, and that's what they do. I mean, aware that that's not actually true. I once played a half-orc cleric of St. Cuthbert, because turns out that, you know, hitting things with a mace is well within the core competency of the half-orc. But I feel like it's something that could be exploited a little bit more. Now, this maybe goes against the idea of the huge pantheon and its accessibility, in that if it's going to matter in your game that we're seeing a different culture slightly nuanced take on a particular deity, then we would already have to establish something about another culture's take on that deity in order for the contrast to be meaningful. But I think if you're going to develop a bunch of pantheons, you should think of them not as discrete bounded things, but as things that overlap and bleed into each other. So that's four fun concepts that you can take from Chinese mythology to make a pantheon in your fantasy game fun. But speaking of the pantheon of Chinese mythology, who got left out? Normally what I do here is I throw in a couple of deities or characters that I think could have been mentioned, like I talked about the bear in Finnish mythology and how it's so important that it feels like it's weird to leave it out of a discussion of the Kalevala, or Ninurta in Sumerian mythology, who's essentially like maybe a late figure and maybe they felt he would fit in better with one of the later sections, whatever. Here, I don't know that I can do that because there are so many deities in the pantheon of traditional Chinese religion that how do you single out the ones who've been overlooked? Right, there are so many, even just like quite big and important ones. There's probably more than we could really discuss. So I'm gonna just cherry pick a few, but stipulating that these are cherry picked, that there's that there are many more that could be equally interesting. Now, the first one, and I think this is an important one, is ancestors generally speaking. So some concept of the veneration of ancestors, important in a lot of cultures, doesn't really turn up in a whole lot of fantasy role-playing game pantheons, which is weird because, I mean, it seems like it would be a great way to provide continuity between different generations. It motivates characters in a simple way. I guess the idea being that PCs tend to be sort of rootless wanderers. You could even have that be, you know, sort of a weakness of them, right? Like, well, you wander from place to place. Well, who's tending the shrines of your ancestors? I think that ancestor worship doesn't really get discussed here because it's outside the deity, 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 deity framework of the Deities and Demigods book. And unfortunately, I think that's kind of a weakness because actually various types of ancestral rites are far more important than at least some of the more minor figures explained here. And of course, respect for previous generations fits in with the sort of fundamentally conservative, ordered hierarchy concept that is so important both in traditional Chinese religion and in Confucianism. Another pair who I thought were really interesting, but who don't turn up here, are Nua and Fuxi, who are ancestral deities. Nua was said to have created humans from clay. I like them for very many reasons, but one of them is that they're often depicted as snake-like. They're often depicted with snake tails, and that's pretty interesting. I realize that's quite a shallow reason to like an ancestral deity, but what can I tell you? In the episode where we discussed Domu, I mentioned Mazu, who's also an ancestral female figure, often associated with the sea and sailors. I understand why she's not in here, since in many ways she fulfills a similar kind of maternal role to Domu, and in fact, for that matter, Guanyin, but I think she's pretty cool, and if you look up some stuff about her, you'll find she's got some good temples, she's got some good traditions associated with her. I think she's interesting to include in games, particularly because I tend to like maritime games. I don't know, it's a pirates thing, and I think there you definitely want to have her as your ocean deity, because she's a lot more interesting than just, like, most ocean deities in fantasy pantheons are boring compared to the ones in real religions. You know, they're just like, oh, it's Foamy McFish, the guy who lives in the ocean. You know, which not even, like, Poseidon is really that. And I think Mazu is well worth looking at. Then you got Shennong, who's like a primal deity who invented all kinds of herbal medicines and agriculture and sort of like peasant things, right? And I think in this pantheon, he's been kind of rolled into Shangdi, and his healing function, I guess, would be redundant with Guanyin. But I like the idea that he is, clearly a god of the common people, which is something that's not very present in the deities and demigods section generally. The same thing is true of 2D or 2D Gong, who is either the Earth God or a group of Earth Gods. I'm not super clear on this one. It may be inconsistent. They may be gods of particular areas of land. But anyway, you know, Earth Gods. It's something that seemed to be missing from this section. I thought, I bet there's actually an Earth God. And indeed there was. And in fact, I just remembered that 2D features quite prominently in Thompson's Chinese Religion and Introduction. Now, I think in this section, he's writing about Taiwan, but this is what he has to say about 2D. The local earth god found everywhere in China, this multiple deity is most numerous because every tiny residential area, even every home, has its own god. Because of his prominence in Chinese religion, every work on the subject discusses 2D. His temples are commonly small and unimpressive. He may even have to make do without a shrine. But the humbleness of his shrines is rather an indication of his closeness to the people than of any contempt for him. It is the earth god who is, in fact, most intimately involved in their lives. And he says that the images of these gods in people's homes are kept underneath the altar, under the floor, so that they can be as close to the earth as possible. And again, there could be loads more. I mean, we're talking about a pantheon that is composed of different regional traditions, different religious traditions. You know, it's hard to apply one concept of, you know, what religious belief is like, quote, in China, close quotes. I don't think you could do that for Norse paganism, a religious belief which has a much shorter historical span and is confined to a much smaller population. So I certainly don't think you can do it for China. But the last thing that got left out is the thing that I'm absolutely astounded got left out, and that's dragons. My copy of Deities and Demigods, and this is the whatever it is, third or fourth printing, has a dirty great illustration of a Chinese-style dragon right there on page 42, right next to the entry for Wenzhong, who is not a dragon, by Dave LaForce. Although there's a second signature, so I think the big stylized D is Darlene Pickle, right? And not Jeff D. It was a big illustration of a Chinese-style dragon, but yet there are no Chinese dragons in this section, and I can only assume that that is because by this time it was already known that they were going to be in the Fiend Folio. Indeed, the two works were kind of in progress at the same time, and at least in theory, Fiend Folio was supposed to come out before Deities and Demigods, just that its publication schedule got messed up and it wound up not being released until 1981. It was supposed to come out in 79, as I understand it. Because, in fact, you know, dragons operate at that level of mythology in Chinese myth, as we saw with the story of Nezha and his conflict with the Dragon King. And goodness knows, people love dragons, right? Players love to have dragons in their game, and they don't just like slaying them, they just kind of like having them around. They're cool. There's, you know, for all that I complain, and I'm not really a big dragon guy, nothing says fantasy setting like some dragons. People like having them around, even if they don't necessarily encounter them, and I think that cosmological dragons in the Chinese mold are interesting in that respect. And if you want to have your kind of lower level dragons, you can just say, okay, well, the proper dragons, those are, you know, the Dragon King, and these other ones are all just his crummy nieces and nephews. But so yeah, get some dragons in there and have them be the kind of like territorial pains in the neck that Nerja encounters. I think, you know, that's a very D&D-ish sort of situation to be in. Well, that's a lot, but hopefully you can see that even if you don't intend to run a Chinese-inspired game, there's a lot of stuff in the Chinese mythology section that you can use to inspire your D&D or fantasy RPG games. In our next episode, though... Okay, so actually, here's the thing. We have two next episodes, because I'm once again going to release an episode of Patron Deities as a free episode that'll just go in the general Monster Man feed, but I don't want to shortchange my patrons. So I'm going to do a free episode and a first episode, basically an episode zero and an episode one of the Cthulhu Mythos section. So we'll do an introduction episode, and then we'll get down to looking at some gods and monsters. And those will come out at the same time. You know, one in both the patron and the Libsyn feeds, and one just in the patron feed. So we're going to do one episode in which we introduce the Cthulhu Mythos and the work of H.P. Lovecraft, and then the next one we're going to jump right in and start looking at the creatures in the Deities and Demigods book. I'm really looking forward to it, and I hope to... Obviously I'm not actually going to see you, but you know what I mean when I say that I hope to see you all there. Thank you for listening to Patron Deities. Thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon, and Happy New Year.